The Parsonage. Tuesday, April 20. We ride, hell for leather. The wind tears at my face and whips my hair into a frenzy. There was no time to pull it back before leaving. I'd had to saddle Brutus as well, not to mention pack my medical bag and change into my riding dress. I met Doctor at the trees, and we were off. Now we gallop, heads down. Brutus and Goliath sense the urgency and propel us forward as mud kicks up at our heels.
Rebecca Foster did not send for you, Doctor shouts, and the wind nearly rips her voice away.
What do you mean?
Her husband called for me at the cabin. He was very specific that I not alert you.
Then why did you? I shout.
Because Rebecca is your patient. I know you care for her.
Doctor points one long finger at me.
And I have long since learned that people only come to me when they are keeping secrets. You will forgive me for being wary of such motives.
It stings, this knowledge that Rebecca would hide her labor from me, that she wouldn't want me there. I delivered both of her sons. How long has it been since you saw Isaac?
Less than an hour, Doctor says.
When did her pains begin?
I do not know.
It is nearing 1 o'clock in the morning now, and I urge Brutus faster. At a full-blown gallop, it will be a 10-minute ride to the hook. Without knowing her condition, it could be 10 minutes too long. The sky is clear and dark as ink, with only a slice of waning crescent moon to guide us. If not for that and the scattered stars, we would have no light at all. As we cross over Mill Creek Bridge, I see a shadow dart out of our way, black and silver with eyes of amber. Tempest watches us speed away. We can hear screaming from the yard. Doctor slides off Goliath's back and tosses the reins to me.
I will meet you inside, she says.
I dismount, then lead both horses to the hitching post to tie them off. They've run hard and bend their heads to the trough for a long, cold drink. I gather my medical bag, uncertain what's waiting for us inside. Isaac is nowhere to be seen, but I know my way around and go directly to the bedroom. Rebecca is arched back against a stack of pillows, shift rucked up to her ribs, legs open, knees bent, eyes closed. A fine trickle of sweat drips down her temple. Her hands fist the quilt beneath her, and her jaw is clenched. Doctor looks at me in that calm, unnerving way of hers and shakes her head slightly. Is she ready?
No,
she says, indicating the hard ball of Rebecca's stomach. It is still high, under her ribs instead of flat and wide at her hips, the way it needs to be for her to push. Doctor waves me over.
Come.
I slide out of my riding cloak and set my bag at the foot of the bed. A single glance tells me that the baby's head has not yet dropped, that despite the pain, this labor is far from over. Once the contraction subsides, Rebecca's eyes flutter open. If she is surprised to see me, she doesn't show it. Or perhaps she doesn't care.
I asked for doctor,
she says. I know, but I am here regardless. I will not leave you alone in this. Where is Isaac? Rebecca lifts her arm and points to the ceiling.
Upstairs, she pants, with the boys. They're scared.
She has no women to attend this birth, no family, no friends. It is only Doctor and I, and I fear we will not be enough.
Make it stop, please.
Rebecca begs when another contraction begins its relentless march through her body. I look to Doctor, not because I don't know what to do, but because she is Rebecca's choice, and I don't want to press my help where it isn't wanted.
The baby will not turn down. I have already tried,
Doctor says. You have tried from the inside as well? She shakes her head.
Pas encore. That requires deux. Une for turning and une for holding the mother down.
Rebecca is wilting, exhausted from the long effort of trying to expel this child from the confines of her body. I plunge my hands into the wash bucket, scrub them with lye soap, then join doctor at the foot of the bed. It has been stripped, all the blankets piled in a corner, and an old quilt is folded beneath Rebecca to catch the blood and water. There is, mercifully, not an alarming amount of either, but the scent of birth permeates the room. The human body has a smell, not just perspiration or defecation, flatulence, blood, but the deep parts of a person, damp and earthy, tinged with a metallic bite of iron. All the moving, beating things that comprise our inmost being. They smell like the natural world, humid and verdant, like soil after the rain. But those are scents that a person rarely notices until a moment like this. Births, accidents, injuries, the various ways in which we are turned inside out. "When did your pain start?" I ask.
"After," she grinds her teeth together. "Noon, in the afternoon."
"Why didn't you send for help earlier?" There, the desperation in her eyes speaks the truth.
"Because I do not want this baby to come."
Rebecca has been laboring for 9 hours with a breech presentation and is fast approaching the limits of what her body and soul can bear. Her movements are weak and rubbery. Exhausted. "It has to come or you will die," I tell her. Slowly, the realization of what I am saying hits her.
"My boys.
They still need you. Isaac still needs you. So we must get this baby out. In order to do that, we have to turn it."
"All right."
"But we cannot do that from the outside." A pause, and then I say, "It is going to hurt. Do you understand what I'm saying?" Rebecca bobs her head, but I can't tell whether it is a nod or a shake. And whether it hurts or not, the work must be done if Rebecca is to survive this night. Doctor presses her palms together, as though praying, then brings them to her face, thumbs brushing her nose. She whispers something in French, and the only word I recognize is Dieu, God. When Doctor opens her eyes again, her only focus is the entrance to Rebecca's womb and the child trapped beyond. "We must wait until the pains ease," she says. "It cannot be done before." This contraction is long and crushing, deep in Rebecca's back, and she arches against it, wailing so loudly that the air catches in her throat, making her cough, then gag. "Breathe," I say, "in through your nose, out through your mouth." The sound of her agony is the most difficult part, but it must be set aside. Even knowing that with her boys, Rebecca birthed them in steely, resolved silence. Nary a moan the entire time. So this difference, the shrieking terror, unnerves me, and I cannot help but wonder how much goes beyond the physical pain of the child's arrival and lies with that of its conception.
"Go up beside her. When I tell you, press on the top of her belly."
Doctor taps the heel of her hand. "With this." I do as I'm told. And as we wait for the last waves of the contraction to fade, I brush the wet hair away from Rebecca's brow and the tears from her eyes.
"I'm sorry," Rebecca whispers, "for not calling for you. I didn't."
"Hush. You have nothing to be sorry for."
"I didn't want you to be here because..."
Doctor nods to me, and I set the heel of my hand on the top of Rebecca's stomach. The moment her belly slackens, Doctor leans forward, whispers,
"Je suis désolé,"
and slides first one, then the other hand into Rebecca's body. She pushes and turns, and I can see the small muscles in her forearms begin to tremble with the effort. For her part, Rebecca splits the air with the kind of scream that is rarely heard off a battlefield. We are all sweating from the exertion within seconds. But when Rebecca's belly ripples from one end to the other, I think that perhaps the wrestling match is won. A gush of water floods the bed, soaking the quilt.
"Bien,"
Dr. Pence. The head is down, but backward. Oh, God, I think. That will double her pain. She doesn't have the strength for that.
She does not have to. But we must work quickly. Turn her over, and the knees. I can do the rest.
It takes both of us to roll Rebecca onto her side, then get her up on all fours. She hisses and spits through her teeth, like a wounded cat. Rebecca's arms shake, and I fear she will fall face first into the pillows. Her strength is gone, but this position seems to help immediately, gravity pulling the baby's head away from her tailbone and into the birth canal. The groan comes, deep and ragged, and I know that another contraction ravages her body. At its peak, Doctor slides two fingers inside Rebecca's body.
I am lifting the head, she says. In a moment, I will guide it out, but you must lift Rebecca's shoulders up. Her body will do the rest.
I climb onto the bed and pull Rebecca up so that her arms are draped over my shoulders and her head is pressed into my breastbone.
Now,
Doctor says, sliding her other hand inside. It is immediate. Rebecca's stomach deflates as the head drops farther into the birth canal.
Push!
She has no choice in the matter. Her body recognizes that this journey is almost over. It seizes, as though being compressed by some external force. And as she bears down, the baby's head emerges halfway.
Again, Doctor demands.
Rebecca obeys with the last of her energy, and the baby slides, slick and angry, into Doctor's hands. Even from where I kneel at the other end of the bed, I can tell that the cord is far too short. 12 inches where it should be 20. No wonder the child hadn't turned. Doctor slices through the cord with a small pocket knife, and I ease Rebecca down onto the bed once more, then roll her onto her back. Below us, Doctor hums as she inspects the child for injuries or defect. Finding none, she lifts the baby.
Vous avez une fille?
I move to the bottom of the bed to clean the child as Doctor tends to Rebecca. As I'm wrapping her in a soft linen cloth, I notice that she has a strawberry birthmark behind her left knee. It is identical to the one on Joshua Burgess's temple. It is proof of Rebecca's claim. It is heartbreaking.
Hello, little one,
I tell the red-faced, squinty little thing. Then I look up at Rebecca.
You have a daughter.
I bring the bundle to Rebecca and hold her out. But she does not reach for the child. Instead, she looks to the tiny, squalling girl once, then turns her face into the pillow and says,
Throw it in the river.
The Kennebec River. I pull Brutus to a stop in the middle of the boardwalk, outside Coleman's General. The snow is all but melted in town. There are muddy tracks cut down the center of Water Street, and the snow drifts are shrinking on either side. The Kennebec groans on my left as the ice splits and forms small glaciers that crash against one another in the building current. It is an astonishing thing to behold, though not altogether safe. The river often floods when it opens, and the banks have been known to shear away as those blocks of ice roll and tumble downstream. The squirming infant in my arms cries out again. The child is hungry and cold, and fussed all the way here as I held her against my chest, snuggled in tight beneath my riding cloak. She needs a mother but has none, and I have been asked to do the unspeakable. We begged, cajoled. Both Doctor and I did all we could to urge Rebecca to put the girl to her breast, but she refused, would neither look at nor hold the baby. An hour, then two. Surely, we thought, Rebecca would relent, but she hadn't.
We cannot hide this much longer,
Doctor whispered, placing the writhing bundle in my medical bag.
You must go now.
We stood in the hallway outside Rebecca's room, listening for Isaac.
I cannot. I have never.
The child is not safe here. You told me as much when you came to my cabin in January. She does not want this baby. Nor can we blame her.
It is wrong.
I shook my head.
I cannot.
If you love her, you must do this, doctor said. Leave Rebecca to me. Take care of the child.
I left carrying my medical bag. Doctor will tell Isaac that the child was dead born, that we have done our duty and buried the remains. She will lie so that Rebecca can heal. Perhaps one day. Once astride Brutus and away from the tavern, I pulled the baby from my bag and tucked her tight to my chest, praying that my angry, tired steed would not throw us both to the ground. I walked Brutus through the hook, keeping a finger beneath the infant's nose to make sure she was breathing. Every outraged, hungry cry was a reassurance that she was not stifled beneath my cloak. All the while, my heart raced, and my thoughts did their best to keep up. But now I must make a decision, and there are no good ones before me. I look to the river, listen as the blocks of ice scrape and grind together. I could do as Rebecca asked. No one would ever know. No one will ever come looking for this child. But that is unthinkable. Hungry and confused, she cries out in my arms once more, and I pull her close.
Shh.
Dawn is still hours away, and the sky above is spread wide. Midnight blue and littered with stars. The shadows mingle, dark and darker, all around us. Brutus twitches beneath me, impatient, and I settle him with my voice, a pat of my hand. The baby shifts in my arms, whimpers again. I know, little one, it is cold and I am sorry. But I have made my decision now and will not turn back. I peel back the blanket until I can see the wide eyes and the tip of that tiny nose. I think of the daughters I buried so long ago, of their graves, 220 miles away in Oxford, three in a row, beneath an oak tree. They are lost and gone, and I would give most anything to hold them again. I would give my own life if it meant they could have theirs back. What your mother does not yet understand, I tell the baby, my voice choked with emotion, is that there are some losses in this life that we do not live long enough to fully grieve, and I'll not give her another one. I tuck the baby girl under my riding cloak once more, safe from the cool night air, and turn Brutus onto Winthrop Street. White Saddlery. Sarah White answers the door. I did not expect her to be awake, much less dressed, but there she is, as though expecting me, as though I've been invited. And here I thought I'd have to get through her mother first. May I come in? I ask. Of course, she says, and pulls back the door to let me in. I don't realize at first why she throws a questioning glance over her shoulder. But once I've knocked the mud off my boots and stepped inside, I see a man sitting beside the fire. He is young and handsome, and there is a bundle in his arms. When the bundle squirms, then snores, I realize that he is holding Charlotte. Sarah opens her mouth to explain, but there is no time. I need your help, please. Come in, she says. Tell me, I will help in any way that I can. I do hope she truly means that, because when I get to the fire and pull back my riding cloak to reveal the newborn, squirming baby, she gasps. The man does as well, although he adds a colorful invective to go along with his stare. Abashed, he sets his palm over Charlotte's ear, says it again, but whispers this time. She was born almost 3 hours ago and has not eaten. Are you still making enough milk for two? God bless Sarah White, and may he curse anyone who speaks a harsh word against her ever again. For she immediately drops into the other chair and begins to unbutton her blouse. I look to the man, back to Sarah. Perhaps he ought, she laughs.
Don't fret about my modesty, Mistress Ballard. He's seen it all before.
Sarah reaches for the baby, smiling, as though she's just been offered a prize and not a burden.
This is Charlotte's father, Henry Warren. I told you he would come back for us.
Well, I need to sit down. I lower myself to a chair beside the hearth, gape at him while Sarah lifts the baby to her breast. The little girl clamps onto her nipple with a ferocity that amazes me. She sucks and gurgles, slipping off the breast, screaming, starving, angrily swatting the air with her tiny fists. She grabs hold again, little mouth working in desperation while Sarah expertly adjusts both child and breast for a better fit. She rocks the baby, shushes her, strokes her ear and temple with a long, soft finger, and all the while Henry watches in wonder, as though Sarah is nursing his child and not a stranger's.
Does she have a name?
Sarah asks. I shake my head. She looks at me through long, dark lashes, and I can see her mind work.
Does she have a mother?
Again, I shake my head.
I see. Am I to keep her then?
Only as long as you're willing. I must confess that my only thought was to get her fed, not what happens next. But I will think of something, I promise.
I am happy to help you, Mistress Ballard. It's the least I can do, considering all you've done for me. Thank you,
I sigh, and lean back, then close my eyes for a moment and let the heat from the fire seep into my body. When I open them again, I see that the young man is staring at me now.
I'm sorry, I've failed to introduce myself. I am Martha Ballard, a midwife, and a friend of Sarah's.
I extend my hand and he accepts it. I'd gathered as much. I'm Major Henry Warren, Sarah's fiancé.
I looked to Sarah, stunned. He asked me this evening, walked right in the door and asked me.
We plan to post notice tomorrow and be married within the month.
The smile Sarah gives me is almost pitying. I know you didn't believe me. No one did. Everyone thought I was a fool. But they don't know Henry. He promised, and I believed him. It is as though someone has tossed my mind beneath the stampeding hooves of a charging herd of horses. There is so much to make sense of all at once.
But before I can reckon with the fact that Sarah's lover has returned for her, there is one thing that I have to know. I turn to Henry.
Do you know a man named Joseph North?
Isn't he the judge in this town?
Yes.
I know him by name only. I have never met the man.
Well, he claims differently. I do not know this Henry Warren any more than I know Latin or Chinese, but I do like the way his eyes pinch in alarm and how he pulls Charlotte tighter against his chest.
What do you mean?
Judge Joseph North has sworn to the court that he was with you on the night of August 10th last year when he is accused of raping a woman in this town.
On August 10th, I was 300 miles west of here. Same as I've been for the better part of a year. Until December, when we got orders for Fort Halifax. And there are 24 men at the tavern who will testify to that.
I ponder this. Nod. I had to ask, I tell him.
Henry doesn't seem the least bit offended.
I wouldn't expect less of anyone who cares about Sarah. But I don't like that he's used me as an alibi. I'm happy to write to the court and certify otherwise.
The trial has come and gone, and North has been acquitted.
I don't care. I don't want my name associated with his.
Tell me who I must speak with about this. I want it official.
His name is Seth Parker, and we will deal with that later. But thank you.
Now that that is out of the way, I have another question for him.
Did you know about Charlotte?
No, but I knew there was a possibility of a child. I had to finish my enlistment with the militia. That's what took me so long. I've made arrangements for us, here in Hollowell.
Sarah beams. He's bought Coleman's store. You're the man from Boston.
I am.
And I thought that's where we'd have to live. But my grandfather died last year, left me a bit of an inheritance, and that gave me the option of moving here instead. When I told Samuel Coleman about the story of Emmeline by Charlotte Turner Smith, he had laughed, said it sounded like a fantasy. And yet, here is a woman who did the very same thing as that character. Sarah has lived on the fringes of society, yet she's chosen the course of her life. She's found love on her own terms. And I'll be damned if she likely won't end up wealthy and happy as a result. Just wait until I tell Coleman how very real the premise of that novel is after all. I am overwhelmed with both joy and exhaustion, and the sensation feels very much as though I am a candle wilting over an open flame, with my wick burning at both ends. I have so little energy left, and I can feel my mind getting fuzzy. It is time to go home. Martha.
Yes?
Sarah tilts her chin toward the baby. She is milk drunk and has fallen off the breast, asleep, her mouth open, milk dribbling from one corner. What should I call her? I smile. I think Emmeline would be a fine name. Mill Creek Bridge. It is nearing 5 o'clock in the morning when I urge Brutus into a lope. I am too exhausted to ride this hard, but I want nothing more at this point than my own bed, my own pillow, and the soft, worn quilt on top. Now with home only moments away and my nerves still raw, I cross the bridge and turn west up the lane. Once again, I nudge Brutus to go faster, but we've not made it a quarter mile when a living shadow melts out of the woods. Tempest darts into the road in front of us. Her eyes are an amber flame blazing in the dark. The fox barks out a ferocious warning, and Brutus rears back, four legs pawing the air in alarm. The movement catches me off guard, but not so much that I'm unseated. Tempest looks directly at me, warning and fear and something else reflected in the light of the moon. She sniffs the air, searching for my scent, and takes another step forward. Brutus flicks his tail, snorts. He sees only sharp teeth and wicked claws. He knows nothing of my fondness for this creature. I am unprepared for the buck. Off balance, arms akimbo, and then, before I can adjust or pull in a full breath, I am tumbling through the air over his head. The horizon, now pale and silver, spins, and the earth rushes toward me. I have gone forward, arse over tea kettle, and though I try to land on my feet, I cannot tell up from down, and there is no time to judge my position in the air. I hit the ground, hard, on my back, breath rushing from my lungs in a guttural oof, before I can protect myself from the fall. I feel the impact everywhere. My ribs throb, my head aches, my hips feel battered. And even though it is dark, bright little lights spin in front of my eyes, dancing to some nauseating rhythm. I taste blood and know that I have bitten my tongue. The thing that scares me most, however, is that my mouth opens and closes, but my lungs refuse to pull in air. I gasp and flail like one of Cyrus's fish when pulled from the pond. I cannot breathe. I roll onto my side, trying not to panic. It takes another long, frightened moment, but I am finally able to pull a thin stream of air into my burning lungs in a ragged, wheezing whistle. It feels like water and fire, life and death, and I lie there drinking in both. My lungs aflame, drowning, burning. The sound I make, trying to breathe, would have me on my knees begging God for help if this were a birthing room and I heard a woman in this state. But it is only me, beneath the stars, winded and wounded. Think. Breathe. Think. Breathe, I tell myself. You cannot die here alone in the middle of the road.
Brutus is 50 feet away, stamping the ground, impatient for me to get up.
I'd kill him if I could. That's how much I hate that stupid, ruthless brute of a horse right now. Worst decision I ever made. Worst money I ever spent.
Wheeze. Gasp. A breath. Deeper now. But still the burning. I am furious. My own horse has tried to kill me. I glare at the damned stubborn stallion. I should have castrated him when I had the chance. Ephraim was right. That's the only way to tame a wild beast. The cold and wet seep into my clothing, my bones. And I know that I should get up, that I cannot lie here forever. I am certain, mostly, I think, that nothing is broken. But my body is slow to rise. There is a soft padding near my head, the tiny crackle of little feet moving through leaf and mud. And then there she is, my fox, all dark and silver in the moonlight, her startling eyes locked on me. Tempest, I say nothing. Don't budge an inch. I barely allow myself the air that my lungs are screaming for, because the fox is sliding forward, one delicate paw after the other. And now she is only a whisker's breadth away, staring at me as though I am the most curious creature on earth. I would never have believed such a thing could happen. Have never heard of such a thing in my life. Tempest, my own little fox, eases her slender head forward and sticks out her pink tongue. Once, just once, she licks the tip of my nose. It's a greeting, a peace offering, some acknowledgement that we are one and the same. But it is fleeting, gone as quickly as it came, just like her, because in one bound she springs over my head, nose pointed toward the house, tail toward Water Street, and begins to bark. There is nothing comely or tender about the sound this time. They are vicious little snarls that rip the air and snap my senses into order once again. I struggle to my feet and back away, not because I am afraid of Tempest, certainly not, but because I realize that these are warning barks. We are not alone in the woods. But in the distance, I hear an answering call, another fox, her mate, perhaps, somewhere closer to the house. I turn to Brutus, just in time to see him spin around and bolt in the opposite direction. That traitor has run off and left me. A tu, Brute. I limp toward the mill. My ankle is sprained, and a cut runs the length of my right forearm, dripping blood into the cuff of my sleeve. My breath comes easier now. But still, there is a whistle at the end. A dispute lodged by my body for its recent treatment. Brutus is gone, run off toward the hook, and has taken my medical bag with him, so I do not even have my bandages. I'm still cursing the beast when I step out of the woods and see a lantern burning in the mill window. Ephraim, I wheeze and shuffle faster. A horse is hitched to the post, snorting deep in the shadows, and a long rectangle of pale light slips out from the door and falls onto the muddy yard. I turn sideways and slide through the narrow wedge of open door. That damned horse threw me again, I say. Mark my words, I'm selling him for glue. At the sound of my voice, a low, angry growl fills the room. Cicero. He lies on the floor beneath Ephraim's workbench. He lifts his head from his paws and rounds his spine slightly, all the bristly hair standing on end, teeth bared, eyes flashing. No wonder the foxes are barking tonight.
His master stands a few feet away, flipping pages in a book that I immediately recognize as my journal. He looks up at me, dispassionate.
I would like to know,
Joseph North says, ripping a page from the spine,
what you were really doing in my house yesterday.
Get out, I say, grabbing onto one of the large central posts for support.
No.
Ephraim will be home any moment.
That excuse didn't work the first time,
North says, tearing another sheet of paper from the book. It falls to the floor and settles at his feet.
And I'm rather weary of hearing it. Your husband is in Boston, petitioning his claim to this property. My children are all in bed, asleep. You are alone, Martha. The question is whether you are afraid.
Rip! The sound echoes through the mill. This time he wads the page with his fist and throws it to the corner. No, I am not afraid of you.
Rebecca was afraid when we went to her that night. You should have seen the way her legs trembled on that bed.
He says it so casually, as though he doesn't care that he's confessing to a crime.
Don't worry, he adds. I'm not incriminating myself. I've been acquitted, remember? I can't be tried again.
Get out, I tell him, the air hissing through my teeth, ribs creaking in protest. I wonder if I broke something after all. Cicero leans forward at the note of anger in my voice, bares his teeth.
No. You and I are going to have a little talk, and we're going to start with why you were in my house.
Medicine for your wife. His eyes narrow.
You're hurt.
I wince, but do not answer him.
Well, that will make this easier.
He turns another page in my journal. Reads a benign entry aloud, pats his mouth as though yawning.
Where is my letter, Martha?
I don't know what you're talking about.
You are a terrible liar.
I wish I could say the same about you. He laughs.
No doubt I've had more practice.
I summon every bit of nerve that I have, stand as straight as I'm able. Get away from my journal and get off my property.
It's my property now. But I think we might come to an understanding.
North holds up the journal by its spine, then yanks out a fistful of pages. If one could rip my soul in half, that would be the sound. He shakes them in front of me.
I underestimated you.
I never knew you kept this book until the first hearing. I need to run. Everything about North, his demeanor, his words, everything feels dangerous, unhinged. But I wouldn't make it to the path before he caught me. I could scream. There's a chance one of the children would hear me. But which one? Hannah? Dolly? Young Ephraim? I would pray for Jonathan, but he was passed out drunk not 5 hours ago. Cyrus is the best option. But there's no certainty he'll be the one to come running.
If not for this, Rebecca's claims would have never made it past the first hearing.
North yanks at the book again, and my eyes sting as I watch a week's worth of careful documentation being torn in half. I ease back toward the door, but Cicero is on his feet now, growling deeper, edging closer, and I stop. I lift my hands. Palms out to ease him back. He sits back on his haunches in the middle of the floor. North snorts, tears out another page. Why did you rape Rebecca? I ask. Stalling is the best option I have now. Keep him talking. Give Cyrus time to get up and get to work.
I taught her a well-deserved lesson.
You broke her body and destroyed her life. You forced a child upon her. What did she ever do to you? North looks at me, lips twitching in fury.
She brought those damn Indians into this town, not once, but 2 dozen times. Do you know how long it took us to root
the Wabanaki out of this place? 7 years. 7 years of war with the French and their barbaric allies, and she waltzes into the Hook with her high ideals and that idiot husband and invites them into her home. It could not be tolerated. Who she associates with is none of your business. Everything to do with this town is my business. I was here before any of you. And I'll not have this place polluted by our enemies. I shake my head. He truly believes what he's saying. You raped her because of the Wabanaki? Because of a grudge held over from some old war? You are a judge. You had no right to violate your oath of office. I had every right. He thumps his chest. I am the judge. I decide what is just. You are a disgrace. He laughs, but there is no mirth in the sound. Rebecca Foster is just a cunt. Same as you. Same as every woman. Just a nice wet hole to dump a bit of seed, nothing more.
Samuel Coleman is right. This man has lost his soul. It is the only way to justify such a belief. He was born of a woman, after all. He has a wife and grown daughters. He moves through a world that is equally filled with women. What happened to you, I ask, during the war?
Nothing happened to me. I learned the greatest lesson of my life.
He sounds more like a judge again, and less like a zealot. His voice has slipped into oratory, the kind he uses from the bench. There is no courtroom to lecture, however, only me, and I use this bit of space to test the strength of my wounded ankle. The jolt of pain that shoots up my shin is reminder enough that I cannot run.
If you see something, North says, if you want it, then you must take it. That is how you survive not just a war, but a life. The French and Indians taught me that.
So you are a thief as well as a rapist? I lift my arm and indicate the mill around us. You take land, women, scalps. He flinches at this. And then call yourself a victim when challenged? It is risky, but I need more time. So I press harder, fold my arms across my chest. No, I shake my head. You're no hero. No founding father. You are a coward who runs in the face of justice. You are the kind of man who hides in a dead man's house instead of facing the jail yard. North looks at me, eyes wide, as though astonished I could have figured this out. Let me guess, I say. You couldn't find the eviction papers, so you threw a tantrum and torched Burgess's homestead.
You... he hisses. You have them.
No, not anymore. They are currently in the possession of your employers. And I would imagine the Kennebec proprietors will find this little scheme of yours quite illegal. See it, want it, take it only works when there is no one around you to stop you, Joseph. He is not a man given to silence. Swollen by self-importance, impressed by the sound of his own voice, Joseph North always fills a void with vain and stupid words. But for the first time in our long acquaintance, he closes his mouth. 10 seconds. 20. For 30 long seconds, he shakes with rage.
There is no one to stop me now, is there, Martha?
I should have known where this was headed. He'd made it clear up front with his nonchalant confession. But it isn't until he tilts his head and the look in his eye changes from pious to prurient that I understand the point he has come to make. Joseph North intends to take a pound of flesh.
You have caused me a great deal of trouble, and there is a price to pay for that.
You wouldn't dare touch me, I say, shifting as best I can toward the work table. I need something, anything, to support my weight.
I admit that I have not fantasized about you the way I did with Rebecca. At least not in many years. You were quite lovely when you were young, though. Billy Crane thought so at least, didn't he?
He licks the corner of his mouth as he makes a roving assessment of my body.
Your breasts were smaller then, but your legs just as long.
Billy Crane. I haven't heard that name spoken aloud in at least a decade, maybe more. And the fact that North says it now with his own threat hanging in the air makes my heart trip harder.
Oh, don't look so surprised. You think I don't remember? We hung him from a pine tree, no trial, and I learned a good lesson in the process. Don't get caught.
He takes a step toward me. Touch me and you will regret it for the rest of your life. I edge back, looking for something with which to protect myself.
You will not find me such an easy victim, and you do not have help tonight. I can admit that Burgess was a mistake. He enjoyed it too much, wanted another go at her when he was done, but I didn't need him then, and I don't need him now.
I take another step toward the work table, force the fear out of my voice. So why take him? It was such a stupid risk.
It was brilliant. People might have believed her if she said one man raped her that night, but two, it's ludicrous. A story cooked up by a vengeful woman who's just seen her husband fired. I took Burgess with me so that no one would believe her. You saw how well that worked for me in court. Charges of attempted rape. And then an acquittal.
An acquittal only because she wasn't there to testify.
And whose fault was that?
You are the only one at fault here. Don't you dare try to blame anything on her. I have to keep him talking. That's the thing. He's just so damn impressed with himself. Always has been. And the more he talks, the lighter it grows outside. Men aren't so brave in the daylight as they are in the dark. My children might be asleep, but not for long. This is a farm, after all. And besides, the thing that I want is here, 3 feet away. But if I lunge for it, he will block me.
Come now, Martha. We have business to attend.
North untucks his shirt, pulls at the laces of his trousers.
Don't you dare!
I edge another step closer toward the table.
Go on, try to run, but I don't think you'll get far, not with that ankle.
Cicero swishes his tail across the floor, kicking up a fine cloud of sawdust. He bares his teeth and the dark gums above them. When North tugs his trousers down, and then the drawers beneath, I do not deign to look at the thing he strokes in his hand. Instead, I watch his eyes, wait for him to charge, knowing that I will have only one chance. If he reaches me or knocks me down, the fight will move to the floor and any leverage I have will be lost, along with any hope of defending myself.
It must vex you to know that you can't scheme your way out of this, he says.
I am sweating, at my temples, under my arms, my upper lip. I haven't sweated in 6 months, maybe 7, not since the last time I worked in my garden. Winter has stripped this experience away entirely. But here it is again, assaulting me, unwelcome. The air feels thick and heavy inside the mill. I can smell North's breath, his sweat, his crotch. I can smell the anger seeping from his body. Thump, 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 thump. Faster and faster and faster my heart beats. Smell and memory are linked together. Nothing conjures the latter like the former, and now my entire being is seized with a memory from 35 years ago. Billy Crane, the shed. 4 horrendous minutes with my face shoved into the dirt.
I knew you were scared,
North says. And I cannot deny it. The proof is there in the rapid rise and fall of my chest. The breath that I cannot force into submission. I can hear the blood rushing through my ears like a river that has broken loose from winter's grip, raging,
violent. I know what is coming. My body is aware. It remembers. And it will not be calmed. I lurch toward Ephraim's work table when North takes that first step in my direction. He is faster than I am with a sprained ankle, and he catches me by the hair, yanks me backward, hard. I scream. The pain is so startling that the sound has escaped my lips before I realize I've drawn the breath to cry out. Cicero jumps to his feet again, growls, inches forward. I sound wounded, like an animal. I sound like prey, and he salivates at the noise. North winds his fingers through my hair, pulls me closer, whispers,
"What a pretty penny this would have earned."
"Let go of me!" I scratch at his hands.
"Oh no, you are going to be quiet about this. While I'm doing it and afterward, you'll not say a word because no one will believe you. They'll think it's some bit of petty revenge, just your way of getting back at me after losing in court."
"No one will believe you." It's the line spoken by every man who has ever used a woman in this way. The trouble is that so often they are right. But I am angry now, and I do not want to be used in any way by Joseph North. There is only a foot between us, and we are near the same height, so I do the only thing that I am able. I tilt forward as though trying to move, and when he grips my hair tighter, I smash my head backward into his face. It is North's turn to scream. Then he grunts, curses. He drops my hair and clutches at his bleeding nose. When he lets go, I dive for the work table, scrambling for Ephraim's wicked, curved blade. Revenge. Hilt in hand, I turn. The knife feels heavy in my palm, unwieldy.
"You aren't going to kill me," he says, laughing.
And it's that arrogance, the certainty, that enrages me. "I have no intention of killing you, even though I could."
"Then put down your toy and take what's coming to you."
I grip the knife tighter, lift the blade, and slash the air. Just once. Just close enough that he flinches and raises his arm to block me. Revenge cuts a clean swath through his sleeve, a 3-inch slit that exposes the skin of his wrist. North looks at it, stupefied.
"You stupid little don't touch me!"
I swipe again, and he stumbles backward this time. 2 steps. He nearly trips over his pants. And it's enough that I can maneuver into a better position, press my hips against the work table, support my weight. Anger, fear, both mingle to make my voice unreliable. I do not want to sound weak, so I clear my throat. Even so, it is better to reply one word at a time.
"You will not touch me." "I don't take orders from women," he says.
And then he lunges, hands out as though he would take me by the throat and throttle me. I drop down, ignore the blinding pain that cascades through my knees when they hit the floor, lean forward at a slight tilt, and bring my arm down in a quick, purposeful slash just as his hands grab hold of thin air. I do not swing blindly. I do not miss, and I am not sorry. The blade catches him right between the legs. It is a clean cut, the kind that takes a moment to feel. But when he does, his scream rises high in the early morning air, for revenge has done its job. Joseph North will never rape another woman as long as he lives. North falls on top of me, and now we are a tangle of arms and legs, and Ephraim's blade toggling between us. I try to scramble away, but have no leverage, so I must use my arms to create some distance. I feel him shift on the ground beside me, and I swing wide again, but connect with nothing but air. North isn't coming for me, however. He is bent over himself, hands cupped at his crotch, blood flowing between his fingers.
Cicero goes insane, unsure whether to defend his master or attack, the smell of blood making him frantic.
"What did you do? What did you do?"
he gasps, then begins to cry and curse and swing his arms in my direction, and I feel each drop of blood hit my face. It smells of copper and rust and salt. It smells of fear. I can hear the words that he hurls at me, but they do not make sense together. Random insults, violent but utterly impotent. He screams, gags, curses.
"I told you not to touch me," I say. "I told you to leave."
I scoot away from him and use the work table to pull myself up, wipe the blood on my skirt. I grip the blade as Cicero takes careful, measured steps around his master. He has made his decision and identified me as the threat, the cause of all this pain and screaming. One large paw glides through the slick red puddle, and when he sets it down again, the print is perfect, as though stamped in wax. Revenge is ruthless, but might not do much good against those teeth if Cicero gets them around my arm or throat. My hand is shaking now anyway, and the hilt is slippery in my palm. The dog senses this, edges closer. I had thought that the rising sun might bring one of my sons to the mill for work, but it brings the sound of hoofs thundering down the drive instead. It brings an unholy screeching as well. It rings in my ears. It makes my teeth hurt. Blood. It spreads on the floor beneath North. I feel no pity for him, but neither do I want him to die here in my husband's mill in such a way that I will bear the blame. My intent was to maim, not kill, to teach him a permanent lesson, to ensure that he had one less weapon with which to wound the women of this world. I shrug out of my shawl and throw it to him. "Use that," I order. "Staunch the bleeding." He screams at me, curses through a slobbering haze of fury. "Calm down and do as I say, or you will die." I expect Cyrus or Jonathan, but instead it is Ephraim who steps through the door. I stare at him, stupefied.
"What the bloody hell?"
Ephraim asks when he sees North sprawled out, blood pooling between his legs, as he tries to press my shawl to his groin. Cicero is backing away now, alternating between growls and whines, when Percy swoops through the door and dives for him. The dog yelps, as though he's just been branded, and runs for the door. Percy takes a sharp turn and is after him, talons extended. My journal is on the floor, torn to shreds, and I am crying at the sight of my husband. I drop revenge. The blood feels oily on my hand, and I wipe it against my skirt. He was waiting for me when I got home. I look directly at Ephraim and try to communicate everything in two sentences. I told him not to touch me. He wouldn't listen. My husband goes still, quiet. His pupils dilate, and he takes me in, looking for injury. Then he turns to the gory sight of North twitching on the floor. He understands what I am trying to say.
"Are you hurt?"
The question is both gentle and ferocious. "Only because Brutus threw me."
"I thought as much," Ephraim says. "I caught him on Water Street."
I test my weight on the sprained ankle, limp toward Ephraim anyway. "North needs a doctor." Ephraim studies him on the floor.
"There isn't time," he says.
"But
it will take too long to get him to the hook. Without help, he'll bleed to death. If he's to be saved, it will have to be by your hand."
Saving Joseph North is the last thing I want to do. But we cannot let him die here, not after all that's happened. Ephraim moves toward him, and North growls,
"Do not touch me. You would give me orders in my own home? After what you have done?"
Ephraim goes to stand over him.
"If you aim to die, it will not be on my property."
Still, North howls and spits and curses at me. and through clenched teeth he heaves every possible insult he's ever heard for the female species. A moment ago, he thought me weak, vulnerable, and perhaps I was, but I am not helpless. It is a pity you hate women so much, I tell him, because you are going to spend the rest of your life pissing like one. There are 1,000 things I want to know about how Ephraim came to be here in this moment, but given the look on his face as he surveys the gravity of North's wounds, my questions will have to wait. He has only just realized what his blade has done.
Martha, he says,
and I hear the note of uncertainty in his voice. I will need my medical bag and a great deal of ice. I am a midwife. I am a healer. I do not take life. I shepherd life into this world. This is what I tell myself as we staunch the bleeding. Ephraim applies the pressure as North slips in and out of consciousness, his eyes growing wide in alarm, then rolling back until only the whites are showing. Every time he comes to, his body twitches, but then the pain takes him away again, and he flops back to the floor. The bleeding is the main problem, but once we have it under control, I go to work with needle and thread. There isn't much left to sew. The cut was clean and effective, and time will have to do the rest. I rinse the wound with a tincture of witch hazel so that infection will not set in. Once I've tied off the last stitch, I pile a mound of ice on top of the wound. This will both temporarily numb the pain and shrink the blood vessels. But North is restless, twitching. He won't stay asleep for much longer. What I wouldn't give for Dr. Page's bottle of laudanum. When I look at Ephraim, there is an ocean of sadness in his eyes. I told him not to touch me, I say. Stop. You will not blame yourself for what happened here tonight, or for showing him mercy. I doubt North will ever call this mercy. If it hadn't been mercy, you would have gone for his throat. I cut exactly where I meant to, Ephraim, an eye for an eye. Then we'll call it severe mercy, love. He comes to sit beside me on the filthy stained floor. Will he live? I don't see why not. Assuming there is no infection or fever, which there shouldn't be if the wound is kept clean. And are you going to do that for him? Absolutely not. He will get no further ministrations from me. He can find his own nursemaid. What should I do with him then? Take him to Dr. Page. As I recall, the good colonel here has a great deal of respect for that buffoon's medical experience. We'll see how satisfied he is with the care he receives.
And what will I tell Dr. Page about these wounds?
I look around the mill, at a loss for an answer. But then I settle on Ephraim's work table and the row of clean, shining knives. It isn't uncommon for inexperienced woodworkers to have an accident with a drawblade, particularly when they don't wear that leather apron.
And if North argues that explanation,
then he can explain that he broke into our home, attacked me, and was castrated in the process. But if I know anything about the man, that's not a story he'll want known. Ephraim looks at the blood on my hands, on my dress.
And what about you?
I'm fine.
No, you're not.
I will be. Eventually.
And until then, what will you do?
I have not slept in 24 hours. I am going to bed. Wednesday, April 21. Tired and battered though I was, I couldn't sleep when I made it back to the house. I could only wash my face and hands and light the hearth fires. By the time the children got up and about, I'd collected myself, and they didn't know there was anything wrong, nor did they think it strange when I asked them to draw and heat water for a bath. It was only when Ephraim came home and stomped right to our bedroom that they cast wary glances at one another. Not finding me there, he'd come to the workroom, and we have been shut inside together ever since, whispering. The door locked. He pulls a new journal and a box of ink from his satchel and lays them on my table.
"For you," he says.
And that is when I begin to cry. It is a heaving that begins deep within my chest, a current that bursts the dam of resolve that I keep so firmly in place. I weep, long and loud enough that I know our children can hear it on the other side of the door. Ephraim pulls me against his chest and lets me wring out every tear. After several long moments, he pulls away and takes in my appearance.
"You need a bath," he says.
"I know. The girls are heating water."
"Get undressed," he tells me. "I'll collect everything."
Soon I am standing in the wash tub as Ephraim pours hot water over my body. It is only 3 feet wide, certainly not as luxurious as a copper tub, but it is better than nothing. And I am filthy, covered with the muck of birth and mud from the road and blood from North. It has been less than 8 hours since I delivered Rebecca Foster, 5 since I left her daughter in the care of Sarah White, 3 since Ephraim loaded North into the wagon and made for the Hook.
"I caught Brutus on Water Street. That's how I knew you were in trouble," he says. "I grabbed his reins and tore home as fast as I could. But when I heard you scream," Ephraim takes a deep breath, shakes his head. "Brutus had gone for help, and you'll not convince me otherwise. That horse loves you."
"I thought you hated him."
"Not anymore."
"He tried to kill me. How many times does he have to throw me to prove that?"
"If he threw you, he had a reason."
"It was the fox. She darted out in front of him. I think..."
I pause because I know it will sound ridiculous.
"What?" "I think she was trying to warn me. She knew that North and Cicero were waiting for me."
"That makes sense."
"Oh, that's the thing that makes sense to you in all of this?" He looks out the window to the giant live oak that grows in the south pasture.
"Foxes and coyotes are natural enemies, love."
Something about the way he says this makes me think that he is no longer speaking of Tempest and Cicero. But my mind is filled with all the things he doesn't yet know, and I must keep them in order. So I put this observation aside.
"Sit," Ephraim points at the tub. "I'll wash your hair."
"There's no room."
"There's room enough.
For my bottom only. My knees are bent and my feet rest on the floor, but the water comes up to my ribs. And sitting feels much better than standing on my lame ankle." He pours a pitcher of water over my head and it runs down my neck, down my back. I tilt my head back, look at his worried face, smile sadly. "Thank you."
"Tell me everything," he says.
I wrap my arms around my knees and start at the beginning, with Jonathan and Sally and our new grandson. He is neither surprised nor entirely displeased in our son's choice of girl. "He didn't choose her," I say. "She trapped him."
"You cannot have it both ways. Only recently you were complaining that he hadn't yet found a wife."
"He still hasn't. Not really. He's only found a girl willing to let her skirts be thrown up in the woods." He sighs, pours another pitcher of water.
"Don't let him off so easily. He went to bed with her willingly enough. There's choice in that. And now there's a child. Have they posted their intent to marry?"
"Last night."
"Good."
"I can't say he was happy to do it. He went back into the tavern and soaked himself in whiskey afterward." Ephraim shakes his head.
"Our daughters are in such a hurry to marry, and our sons in no hurry at all."
"Cyrus would if he could."
"Still no luck with Sarah White?"
"No, though I am loath to admit it, you were right. She has made her choice, and it isn't him."
"Who then?"
"That is a long story involving Rebecca Foster."
"Explain that to me."
"I will, once I tell you why Joseph North came to the mill. I go back to my place in the story, where I was called to attend Sally. Then I tell him how I went to North Manor to give Lydia her medicine, how I found the letter that North was drafting to the Kennebec proprietors. It's in my medical bag, there in the corner. Ephraim pauses his ministrations to dry his hands and read the letter.
Now I understand, he says. North's lawyer, Henry Noland, is an agent of the Kennebec proprietors. Or at least he was. I'd wager he loses the position after Paul delivers the documents to them.
Documents?
A scheme the two of them had to take leases for themselves and gain a monopoly on the lumber trade in Kennebec County. This letter proves it. It also proves that he meant to use our property as a base of operations.
But why take ours? Why not just build his own? There are thousands of unclaimed acres here. Most of what he's requesting in that letter is open land.
Perhaps, but it doesn't have access to the river. Joseph North is a lazy man, Martha. He doesn't want to go to all the hard work of building a thing himself when he can take it from someone else.
See it, want it, take it, I think. He's never changed. That doesn't explain why he had our lease assigned to Burgess first.
I think you were right about that to start with. He bought Burgess's silence with the promise of our land.
Burgess never made any secret of wanting property with river frontage, I say.
It's likely how he talked Burgess into going to the Fosters that night in the first place. Burgess got what he wanted, and North got something to hold over his head. A way of controlling the property without having to do any of the work.
That's a long game to play.
I found his original lease request, and it was for this property.
I craned my neck to look at him. How did we get it then?
Ephraim smiles. Paul's letter of recommendation.
Of course, Paul. We had arrived in Hollowell in 1778, almost halfway through the Revolutionary War, thanks to a letter of recommendation written by the famed silversmith not 3 years after his infamous ride through Charlestown, on a horse borrowed from my husband, no less, the same night Ephraim had taken that dirty punch and got his nose broken. Then I take it to mean that you have settled the issue of our eviction?
I have.
And gained a bit of influence in the process.
You are looking at the newest agent of the Kennebec proprietors. No one can try to wrest this property away from us again. We have been on the property 12 years this month.
So North did everything he could to steal it in the limited time he had between October and April.
But we have officially fulfilled all the terms of our lease. We own the land now.
That's a relief. I am too old to start over in a new place.
Ephraim takes the soap from its basket, plunges it into the water, and begins to lather my shoulders. Keep going, he says. You found the letter in North's office, and then what?
I took it, obviously. And then he walked in. I got away by telling him that I'd only come to care for Lydia. But he figured out the letter was missing soon enough, and came looking for it later. I went to Pollard's after I left his house. I look up. The militia is back.
I meant to tell you that. In December, after I got back from doing that survey, they were stationed at Fort Halifax when I was there. Said they'd be coming through again this spring.
Well, they have.
And Sarah's man, is he with them?
I'm getting to that. I tell my husband how I came home and waited up for Jonathan after being at Pollard's, and how doctor arrived to tell me that Rebecca was in labor. I tell him of the difficult birth, the delivery, and what Rebecca asked me to do afterward. His hands still as he waits for me to finish. They rest on my shoulders, warm and soapy. I took the baby to Sarah White, I tell him. She has her for now, until I can think of something different. Sarah also has a fiancé. His lip curls into a smile.
Her soldier.
Indeed. You would have never convinced me that he'd come back, but he did. And I have to say I'm glad to see it. He's bought Coleman's store, and I think he'll give her a good life.
Hold on for a minute. I'll go get more warm water.
He's back 2 minutes later with a fresh kettle and a hair comb.
Go on.
I continue, telling him about how Brutus was startled by the fox on our way home, how he threw me, and finally about finding North at the mill. He wants to know every detail about our confrontation, everything North said and did. He doesn't like the details, but he listens quietly as he washes my hair with the soap.
"I've been thinking about something," he tells me.
"What?"
"That dog of North's.
Cicero?
He's the one that got into Percy's muse."
"I know.
He's half mutt, half coyote, best as I can figure."
"Okay."
"The thing about a half-tamed dog is that it's still half wild. That can't be changed."
"And now you're talking about North."
"I am making an observation, love."
Ephraim rinses my hair, then reaches for a small bottle of rosemary and lavender oil. He pours a few drops into his palm, then rubs his hands together. He works it through my hair slowly to ease out the tangles, and then he begins to comb, listening to me all the while. The story ends with details he already knows, a knife and blood.
"Is he..." My voice trails off. "Alive?" "Yes," Ephraim says. "You saved him."
"Did Paige ask what happened?"
"He did. And I gave him the answer you suggested. North didn't contradict a word of it."
I rest my head on my knees as Ephraim works his way upward with the comb. We are silent for a long while once he abandons the comb and begins to massage my neck and scalp.
"There was quite a mess at the mill," he says,
thumbs rubbing circles right behind my ears. I mumble something that almost sounds like I'm sorry, even though I'm not.
"Three buckets of water and some scrubbing took care of the blood," he tells me. "But it took a bit of thinking to figure out what to do with the rest," he says.
The thought makes me queasy.
"Oh, I wrapped it up, stuffed it in a box, and took it to Rebecca Foster."
I sit up straight, gape at him. "Why?"
"It isn't much as far as justice goes," he says, "but it's better than nothing, and that's exactly what I told her."
"What did she do?"
"Threw the whole thing in the fire, box and all, then sat in her chair and cried."
The tears are good, I think. That's a start, at least. I am cold now, and when Ephraim sees the goose flesh rise along my arms, he helps me out of the tub. Helps me dry off, helps me into a clean dress, and onto the stool before my desk. He wraps my swollen ankle in linen bandages. "What did you learn in Boston about Cyrus's arrest?"
"Henry Nolan paid a man to have that warrant forged. He delivered it to the court in Vassalboro himself. Obadiah Wood had no idea Nolan was representing North. They arrested Cyrus on what they believed were orders from a higher court. Nolan has been charged with bribery and corruption. He'll lose his license to practice law."
"And what of the charges against Cyrus?"
"Permanently dropped."
"Good. Because he didn't kill Burgess," I tell him.
"I know."
"Nor did Isaac Foster."
"Never thought he did."
"And it wasn't Joseph North either."
This surprises him. "You're sure?"
"Quite."
"Then who?"
I take a deep breath. Tell him what I've finally figured out.